form. Committee Secretary, can we confirm that we have a quorum to start the meeting?
Good morning, Chair, and to everyone on the platform. Chair, we're correct. We may start. Shall we proceed with doing the roll call, Chair?
Yes, please.
Chair, Mr. Mbuyani.
Chairperson, good morning. Good morning, colleagues. I'm present. Thank you.
Good morning.
Chair, Ms. Mwatse.
Good morning, Chairperson, and good morning, everyone. I'm present.
Morning.
Chair, Ms. Mutahum.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, everyone. I'm present.
Good morning. Chair, Mr. Mulder.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, all. I'm present.
Good morning.
Chair, Mr. Malamakia.
Morning, Chairperson. Morning, colleagues. I'm present.
Good morning.
Chair, Mr. Swing.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, colleagues.
Morning.
Chair, Mr. Cuthbert.
Morning, Chairperson.
Good morning.
Chair,
recording
Dr.
in
Parker.
Progress.
I'm here, Chair. Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Chair, those are all members on currently on the platform. Chair, thanks.
Okay, no, that's fine. Can we have apologies, Committee Secretary?
Chair, we have not received any formal apologies yet, so I'm assuming members one may still join us, or I will still receive apologies, Chair.
Okay,
Chair,
Mr. thank you.
Raise his hand, Chair.
Honourable Cuthbert.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable Maxierson will most probably be back for tomorrow's meeting, but he won't be attending today due to party work.
Okay. We note that apology. Can we have a move and a seconder for the adoption of the agenda, please? Do we have the agenda for today? So we're dealing with a briefing by the Minister on WTO and then also on the Black Industrialists and Exporters Conference, and then we'll have the formal consideration of the BRRR. Can I see hands for the adoption of the agendas table? Members? Honourable Mbuyani?
Chair, thank you very much. I propose that you adopt the agenda as presented. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Mwatse.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I second the move of the adoption of the agenda as presented.
Thank you very much. So our first order of business is committee business. And there, I just want to announce to the committee that under committee business that in terms of rule 158.2b, I have received a communication from the minister requesting that we postpone the engagement for today on trade and trade related matters. So we will deal with the WTO briefing from the minister, and I've agreed to that request, and the matter will be then of trade and trade related matters will be then scheduled for the first term of 2023. And then furthermore, also to do with the program, I've received a request from Mr. Mwale, the Free State MEC of Economic, Small Business Development, Tourism and Environmental Affairs for a postponement of its engagement originally scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, the 16th of November. So we've agreed to move it to next week due to prior commitments of the MEC. And we've rescheduled that engagement for Tuesday, the 22nd of November. Then We will next consider now the briefing by the minister, and the purpose of this meeting is to receive a status report on South Africa's current engagements and outcomes in relation to the WTO trade negotiations. So I think the minister is on the platform. I've seen him. So over to you, Minister.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, Honourable members.
Good morning.
And I also greet members of staff of Parliament and the members of staff of the department and any members of the public that may have joined. We have today, Chairperson, quite a significant delegation from the department led by the DG and a number of the staff members would be known to the committee members. We also have a double presentation today dealing with both the World Trade Organization Ministerial Conference as well as the Black Industrialist Conference. I'm going to Chairperson, with your permission, go straight into the WTO presentation, given that within the limited time we're going to try to deal with two quite significant relationships that are then complemented with regional or other trade institutions. SACU, that's the Southern African Customs Union, is one example of that, as well as SADC and the African Continental Free Trade Area. We have trade agreements with other parts of the world, for example, with the European Union, for example, with four countries in Latin America. And we have preferential access to some markets like the United States. Today's focus, Chairperson, is on quite a substantial element of our overall trade engagement, and that is in the World Trade Organization. The department has circulated a draft presentation to members of the committee, and I will be speaking to that document. And I'm going to ask Tulumushi if she would be kind enough to flight the presentation, and I'll use that as the basis for the input from the department. Thank you. The next slide is really the background, which notes that South Africa is a member of the World Trade Organization since the establishment in 1994. Prior to that date, under the old order, pre-democracy, South Africa was represented at the World Trade Organization's predecessor. And that was a body that administered the Generalized Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, known as GATT. The principal terms under which South Africa was admitted as a member of the World Trade Organization was agreed during the Uruguay round of trade talks under GATT that had started in 1986. And South Africa supports multilateral cooperation to manage the interdependence between countries, and we have supported a rules-based trading system as embodied in the World Trade Organization. However, the WTO rules have exhibited a range of imbalances and inequities that prejudice the trade and development interests of many developing countries. The next slide gives a bit more background of three examples, although they are by no means the only ones. It notes that rules in agriculture allow developed countries to distort trade by supporting their farmers financially, and in that way undermining the comparative advantage of many developing countries on products and food security. There are also industrial subsidies that constrain policy space in developing countries to support their industries or our industries, but those rules don't apply in the same way to advanced economies that provide substantial support to high-tech, knowledge-intensive industries. Rules on intellectual property grant protection to patent rights holders, and on the one hand, it encourages and it rewards innovation, which is an important part of what we seek to protect and support. But many developing countries have noted that it also unduly limits technology transfer, and it protects monopoly rents, and in many cases does not prioritize access to life-saving technologies. We saw the example in the pandemic. The next slide. Here we highlight a number of challenges that the rules-based system face. They include currently a dispute settlement mechanism that is not functioning, the proliferation of small group negotiation, what we call plurilateralism, and decision-making by individual countries or trading blocs that pose risks to consensus decision-making and multilateralism. There are proposals to further restrict industrial policy in and technology transfer to developing countries, and proposals to narrow the scope of what is called special and differential treatment that provide flexibility to developing countries. And there are wider risks to multilateralism, which includes geopolitical tensions, the effects of COVID-19 on economies, the broader challenge of rising inequality, and the risks associated with climate change. The next slide. Here we deal with MC12, which is the subject of the presentation. The WTO's main decision-making structure is the ministerial conference. They are known as MC, and each time they meet, they get a number, so we've just had MC12, the next one will be MC13. And these are conferences of trade ministers. They meet periodically and they finalize the content of trade rules and agreements. The previous ministerial conference, before the current one that I'm reporting on, was held in December 2017 in Buenos Aires. It was largely deadlocked on a number of issues, including on agriculture and many what are called new issues, e-commerce, investment facilitation, and domestic regulation on services. At the conclusion of MC11, some members launched what they call joint statement initiatives or plurilaterals, which is where a smaller group of countries come together. And initially, these were supposed to be exploratory discussions, but they've evolved into negotiations and binding rules on a number of matters, and they risk fragmenting the multilateral trading system. MC12 was originally planned for June 2020. It was postponed twice due to COVID, and MC12 finally convened in June this year in Geneva. The next slide. South Africa's strategic objective, MC12, was to work with a broad alliance of countries to achieve a concrete outcome in a number of areas. I've identified 5 specific areas: a waiver of certain TRIPS provisions, regulation to address illegal fishing and overfishing, addressing the inequities on e-commerce taxation, food security, and an agreement on terms of reference of WTO. The next slide indicates Yes, just some pictures. The bottom shows South African negotiators busy with U.S. officials on the text. And on the right-hand side, the chairperson of the conference and the director general of the World Trade Organization. The connection of the trade talks with the DTIC's annual performance plan is that there are opportunities for industrialization through trade with the rest of the world. It's an opportunity to secure policy flexibility for South Africa's own industrialization program, and it's an important moment to garner support for a rules-based system globally that we engage with each other based on agreed rules rather than simply the exercise of power between parties. The next slide is just some extract from remarks that had been made, that I had made on behalf of South Africa, and the first female and first African Director General of the World Trade Organization, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala. The next slide, some pictures of our engagement and negotiation with the European Union, with India, and a little bit of highlights of some key outcomes. Next slide. Some of the other areas of work agreed at MC12 included a work program on small economies, agreements on TRIP non-violation and situation complaints. We've also adopted an outcome document that included the need for WTO reform and many declarations that provide guidance for future work on sanitary and phytosanitary matters, on emergency response to food insecurity, and on WTO preparedness for future pandemics. Next slide. The first area we deal with is the WTO TRIPS waiver and COVID-19 vaccine equity. The next slide gives a background. There's something called the TRIPS agreement, and TRIPS stands for Trade-Related Intellectual Property. And this agreement establishes minimum standards for the protection of the intellectual property regime by all WTO members. HIV/AIDS in the early 2000s, and they rose again in the COVID-19 pandemic. In October 2 years ago, during the height of the pandemic, South Africa and India submitted a proposal for what we called a time-bound, proportionate, and limited waiver to remove intellectual property right barriers to the expansion and diversification of production of COVID-19 vaccines, of therapeutics, and of diagnostics. This was a necessary response to address the highly concentrated and inadequate production that exacerbate global vaccine inequity. There was strong resistance from certain developed country members that delayed an early outcome. And by MC12, we had all laid a sufficient basis for a decision on the matter to be agreed. The next slide talks about the process of building support. Between October 2020 and June 2022, South Africa and India put together a wide coalition of countries that supported the proposal for a waiver. We secured the support of 65 co-signatory countries, and an additional more than 50 countries that supported the proposal in their submissions in the WTO, though they were not co-signatories. Support was secured from most developing countries, including all the African Union, all the African Union states, countries like Argentina, Indonesia, China, Bolivia, and Malaysia. And later we had support from some developed countries, including New Zealand, Australia, and Canada. The United States, in May 2021, announced support for a waiver for vaccines, while noting that they would need to consult further on therapeutics and diagnostics. The initial opposition was mainly from the European Union, the UK, Japan, and Switzerland. Although in the European Union, we had, South Africa had secured support from both Spain and Italy, and at some point, there was guarded support by France, but the formal European Union position originally was to say that the TRIPS waiver was not necessary. South Africa and India then secured support from a range of public voices, including scientists, doctors, Nobel laureates, members of parliament. We worked with parliaments across the world. Even the European Parliament eventually came out and supported the broad thrust of the South African Indian proposal. We got support from faith-based organizations and civil society organizations, including UNAIDS. As this broad alliance of thinkers, scientists, and decision makers put forward the case for the waiver, it led to an informal group of four countries that began discussions on a possible compromise. And this was necessary because the World Trade Organization rules is based on decisions by consensus. So in order for a decision to go through at the World Trade Organization, we need to secure the support of all countries and have no country voting against it. Even one country objecting to an agreement can deadlock a matter. The next slide. These four countries, it was also known as the Quad discussions, was comprised of South Africa, India, the European Union, and the United States. We worked also with the Director General of the World Trade Organization, and in the course of those discussions, a number of options were identified and were put to World Trade Organization members for considerations. Following the talks at MC12, and we had all-night sessions on this matter in Geneva, the following was agreed. First, that a waiver be put in place that provides additional flexibility that allows vaccine exports by one developing country to other eligible developing countries, and joint initiatives, in other words, coordination that can take place, and it removes the requirement that when you use the waiver provision, that it should be predominantly for the domestic market. And that was important because the economics of vaccine production is such that it would be difficult to produce vaccines on a commercially viable scale or at a reasonable cost for only one market, unless it is a huge market like the United States or China or so. But for African countries, no single African market is big enough that can enable production of vaccines only for that market. We also secured clarifications of a number of existing flexibilities, including that governments may authorize local manufacturers to produce and export vaccines, that's the ingredients, the substances or elements that make up the vaccine, and the processes that are covered by patents, and that this could be done without the permission of patent holders. We further clarified that an eligible member, just go one slide back, that an eligible member need not require the proposed user to make efforts to obtain an authorization from the right holder. And the reason for this is that there's been experience that companies and countries have had that patent holders tie any applicant in discussions for many, many years without a positive outcome. And in a pandemic, we needed to move swiftly. The next slide proceeds further with the TRIPS decision. And it says the decision can be implemented via executive orders, emergency decrees, government use authorizations, judicial or administrative orders, and it can be done whether or not a member has a compulsory licensing regime in place. One of the clauses states in this waiver that was negotiated, it says determination on adequate remuneration under Article 31H may take account of the humanitarian and not-for-profit purpose of specific vaccine distribution programs aimed at providing equitable access to COVID-19 vaccines. In order to support manufacturers in eligible members to produce and supply these vaccines at affordable prices for eligible members, I should just indicated eligible members refers to those countries that can use this waiver. It was agreed that the countries that could use this waiver would be all developing countries. It would exclude developed countries, and it would exclude any developing country that voluntarily renounces its right to use this waiver. And only one developing country renounced its right to use this waiver, and that was the People's Republic of China. So all other developing countries are entitled to use this. The agreement continues, and I quote, further in settling the adequate remuneration, eligible members may take into consideration existing good practices in instances of national emergencies, pandemics, or similar circumstances, unquote. And that was put in to address the question that when we use the patent of a patent holder, that it can be done without their permission, but that adequate remuneration would still need to apply, that adequate remuneration cannot be determined by the patent holder, that's a decision that governments must make, and that governments will take into account a range of criteria. So these were quite significant consensus that was forged with countries across the globe in negotiations that lasted many, many months and eventually was pulled together in Geneva. The decision is effective for 5 years, and it may be extended by the General Council of the World Trade Organization. And negotiations are now underway to include therapeutics and diagnostics that are needed to address the pandemic. The next slide. This really summarizes what the decision on the waiver means. It represents a step forward in prioritizing human life and public health. It does not fully address all developing country concerns, so there will still be ongoing discussions about future pandemic preparedness, creating more flexibilities and the ability to move with speed. And of course, because it is a negotiation involving developed and developing countries, at the end of the day, the WTO adopted a document that sought to find a reasonable balance between all the competing interests and at the same time give a signal that the developing countries should really be supported in every reasonable way to build capacity to produce vaccines, that vaccines should not be simply a matter of donations by developed countries to developing countries, but that we should also have the ability through industrial production to ensure health security for people in the developing world. The waiver was adopted unanimously at MC12. To be effective, the TRIPS decision requires domestic implementation. South Africa, we've developed a patent bill that is now going through the finalization before submission to cabinet, and it's intended to also give domestic effect to all available TRIPS flexibilities. MC12 adopted a declaration in addition to the TRIPS waiver, a declaration on the WTO response on COVID-19 that initiates a process for improved preparedness against future pandemics, including to diversify production and promote technology transfer. The next slide will take us to the next area that we seek to address, which is food-related matters. So on agriculture and food security, the pandemic, the effects of climate change and the war in Ukraine have all exacerbated food insecurity globally. WTO members are discussing the need to reorient the agriculture negotiations so that we have trade rules that assist countries to increase their food security. Agriculture negotiations are a critical part of the WTO, but this is one of the areas where negotiations are very deeply contested. There's never been a completely happy outcome on agriculture negotiations since the formation of the WTO. The core concern from our point of view is the imbalance arising from massive agriculture subsidies by particularly European countries that limit the production and trade of many developing countries, including on the African continent, on products where they have a comparative advantage. So when Europe, as one of the significant subsidizers of agriculture, protects and supports their farmers, it means that African farmers who don't have governments with the deep pockets are not able to compete effectively with European farmers. There was only limited convergence at MC12 on the reforms needed to agriculture, what are called trade disciplines. The next slide then unpacks this a little bit. It says for most developing countries, the key issues are, and we highlight three of them. First, disciplines on trade distorting domestic support, which is in simple agriculture subsidies. The WTO agreement on agriculture has allowed developed countries to continue their high subsidies. The second one is a permanent solution for what is called public stockholding for food security. The agreement on agriculture, this is now all the agreement before this latest ministerial conference, that agreement explicitly recognized the need to take account of food security. So a number of countries basically buy food from their farmers and they keep it in stocks and they're able to distribute it to a population, often at prices below market prices in order to ensure that populations have access to food. It's in some ways a form of social welfare. India in particular has a very significant public stockholding for food security. At the previous ministerial conference, ministers had agreed that public stockholding programs in developing countries would not be challenged legally, even if a country's agreed limits for subsidies were breached. And it was a temporary agreement, and it was agreed that this would, there would be a permanent solution on the issue. Cotton, there was a need to have a rule on subsidies on cotton that affect the competitiveness of what is known as the cotton form. Let me go to the fourth challenge, which is on the next slide. This relates to the special safeguard mechanism. It's a tool that will allow developing countries to raise tariffs temporarily to deal with import surges or price decreases. The negotiations have stalled on what are the triggers that enable countries to use the special safeguard mechanism. So those are four areas that we've highlighted. Some members have advocated further trade liberalization. They've been led by Australia in particular. South Africa and the African continent's priority is to correct the historical imbalance in the agreement on agriculture that arose from the Uruguay round and ensure fair and equitable trade in agriculture. I should just for a moment pause on the Uruguay round. During the Uruguay round, South Africa was still undergoing the transition to democracy. In fact, when the Uruguay round started in 1986, the country was in a heightened state of conflict, and the old government still represented South Africa, and it made a number of errors and blunders in the kind of commitments that it gave on behalf of South Africa, even though subsequent era, these commitments.
Yeah, I thought there was a guy there when you arrived there who some individuals seemed to be so okay. Thank you, Bob.
Comrade, sorry, Honorable Malamecha, just mute, please.
Yeah. So in the Uruguay rounds, the old government committed South Africa, and in 1994, we were obliged to accept legally all of the commitments made on behalf of South Africa. So there are challenges on agriculture, on services, and on industrial products that South Africa has had because unusually, this whole conclusion of the Uruguay round and the formation of the World Trade Organization coincided with our own path to democracy, and we were not really able to shape the final outcome, with one or two exceptions where before the 1994 elections, President Mandela at the time had sought to intervene. And this was before he was president of a country. It was while he was still president of the African National Congress. The next slide. This highlights what happened at MC12. We adopted the Declaration on the Emergency Response to Food Insecurity. It acknowledged the importance of not imposing export prohibitions or restrictions on agriculture, food, trade, except very limited ones that are permitted by the WTO. The declaration also recognized the role of local production and food stocks in meeting countries' domestic food security objectives. The conference also adopted the ministerial decision relating to the World Food Program. We agreed as members to avoid imposing certain kinds of export prohibitions or restrictions on food trade where stocks have been bought by the World Food Program because a lot of this food has gone to the poorest citizens across the world. And so this was quite a significant thing at a time during COVID when many countries were considering putting in place export restrictions on their own farmers. Next slide. This now deals with the next big area, and we see that fish looking at us with wide eyes. And this introduces the fisheries subsidies agreement. There's been negotiation for a number of years on fisheries. In fact, it was not possible to conclude these negotiations at previous meetings of the World Trade Organization. And these negotiations aim to eliminate certain forms of subsidies that contribute to either overfishing or illegal fishing or unreported and unregulated fishing. It requires effective and appropriate treatment for developing and least developed countries. And this has been one of the challenges. How do you get an agreement where the large fishing vessels of big countries are trawling the world's oceans, and smaller economies are not the big contributors to overfishing? But because we have a global commons, in other words, the oceans really belong to all of humanity, we need to find a way to address this. Many large fishing vessels countries said, well, why don't we all just agree that we won't do more than we're doing now? We limit ourselves to what we're doing now. But that would have locked in the advantage of big players. And so South Africa and a number of countries looked at this and set a range of priorities to safeguard the rights of coastal states, to preserve food security and livelihoods of artisanal and subsistence fishers, to preserve policy space to develop our own fishing sector and the blue oceans economy, and to ensure that any agreement is in line with the objectives of the United Nations, including effective and appropriate special and differential treatment for developing countries. The next slide. This reflects that the agreement we reached at in Geneva in June is the first WTO agreement that seeks to protect the environment. And so it's a contribution to fulfilling the mandate of the United Nations. It prohibits WTO members from providing subsidies to vessels or operators engaged in illegal, unreported and unregulated fishing. It's called IUU. It also limits or prohibits members from providing subsidies to fishing of overfished stock unless the subsidies are aimed at rebuilding the stocks to sustainable levels. And it prohibits subsidies for fishing in unregulated high seas. So this was quite a difficult agreement to get. Many small island nations were very unhappy in the discussions that their views were not always heard. And so we worked closely with them, the ACP countries, to try to forge a common approach to fishing so that we are able to ensure that this generation of humanity doesn't strip the high seas of fish to the point where it becomes unsustainable. You have a massive depletion of fishing stocks, and future generations are unable to take from the bounty of the ocean. Two-thirds of the membership has now ratified the agreement to bring it into force. Negotiations will continue to address subsidies that contribute to overfishing and overcapacity. And if comprehensive disciplines are not agreed within 4 years of the entry into force of the treaty, the agreement would be terminated. So it's a number of qualifications put in, but for the first time after many years of negotiation, we have something that begins to address sustainability. And it's been one that we've built a consensus across island states and big fishing nations, between countries with vulnerable artisanal fishers, these are subsistence fishers, and countries that are in big commercial fishing, between landlocked countries and ocean-facing countries. The next slide really is just introducing the e-commerce matter. So e-commerce, to introduce it, since 1998, the WTO has periodically taken decisions to not impose custom duties on e-commerce transmissions. These are on certain kinds of electronic transmissions. We call it a moratorium. But since that, we've had a rapid expansion of e-commerce, particularly during the pandemic. Many countries have had constrained revenue sources, and others have been worried about the impact of the moratorium on digital industrialization. And so countries question the need to extend the moratorium. A study by UNCTAD estimates that South Africa could be losing $44 million a year by not putting customs duties on 49 digitizable products. There are negotiations in e-commerce rules by some countries, but they're not getting agreement among themselves. And the negotiations address a range of issues. I've highlighted a few there: cross-border data flows, localization of data, technology transfers, and whether there should be a permanent moratorium. South Africa's own position was to continue exploratory work and information sharing under the work program on electric commerce, electronic commerce. The next slide. So at MC12, with vast differences of views between countries, South Africa worked with countries both in the developing world, and we also reached out to developed countries to have a reinvigorated work program on electronic commerce that would look at, among others, competition, what you classify as electronic transmission, what are new technologies, and how can we ensure that across the world, entrepreneurs and citizens have access to those technologies, the implications of e-commerce on traditional means of distribution of physical goods, and the financial implications of e-commerce for developing countries. We agreed that the e-commerce moratorium will end in December next year, or if MC13 is postponed, then by March 2024, unless the General Council of the WTO agree otherwise. And in the meantime, it was agreed that WTO members would engage in structured discussions prior to MC13, and that these discussions will also focus on the impact of the moratorium on revenue losses and digital industrialization. Next slide. This introduces the reform of the WTO. That's a ship with many, many containers on it. Developing countries have, over a number of years, advocated redressing the imbalances arising from WTO agreement. During the Doha development round of the WTO, an agenda was agreed, providing a mandate to rebalance trade rules and put the interests of developing countries at the center of work. In the view of developing countries, this development agenda has been frustrated since 2008. The reform now being advanced by some developed countries raise what we call systemic matters that will change the WTO's architecture and the principles on which the WTO is founded, and also introduce new issues and approaches that may be inimical to development. For South Africa, when we went into the talks, we took the view that WTO reform should rebalance trade rules from the Uruguay round to facilitate Africa's industrialization that it should deliver on what are a number of mandated issues, issues that have been agreed in the past, like food security and like human development, and that it should preserve the WTO core principles and its multilateral character. The next slide. After a long work program by officials, when we got to Geneva, ministers engaged further and we agreed to work towards the necessary reform of the WTO, that the process must be member-driven, open, transparent, and inclusive, that the work will cover all WTO functions, that's negotiation, the monitoring of trade rules, and dispute settlement when parties are deemed to be in breach of their commitments. Work will be conducted by the General Council and its subsidiary bodies, and the idea is to have decisions that can be submitted for adoption at the next ministerial conference. The dispute settlement mechanism of the WTO has been disabled mainly because the United States had concerns on the functioning of the appellate body. And MC-12 recognized the urgency of addressing this challenge with a dispute settlement system and committed to discussions to seek a well-functioning dispute settlement system by 2024. MC-12 reaffirmed the foundational principle of the Marrakesh Agreement, which will underpin WTO reform. Next slide. There are a number of risks from WTO reform, because you have many different agendas across the world. The reform of the dispute settlement mechanism could potentially see a return to the pre-WTO era, where dispute resolution was shaped by trade power rather than due process. Another risk is efforts to introduce the plurilateral agreement that will undermine key principles and consensus decision-making. Potential new rules that can constrain industrial policy-making. A narrowing of the scope of special and differential treatment. The erosion of a member-driven process. And critically, the climate change measures, if they're not carefully handled, can have a negative impact on many developing countries through new environmental tariffs and non-tariff barriers such as the carbon border adjustment mechanism, or sometimes it's called the carbon border tax. The next slide just highlights for South Africa what we seek: to address policy space on global agreements to enable African industrialization, retaining the development focus of the WTO and special and differential treatment, effective dispute settlement, strengthening the multilateral character, and preserving the consensus decision-making principle and other principles. Next slide. This really just wraps it up, that the success at MC12 was due to the broad coalition of countries. South Africa worked hard with both North and South to help pull a sufficient coalition together, and we were supported by a number of other countries that had a similar view, that the final outcome provides some support for citizens through the flexibilities that we gained in the TRIPS agreement, to consumers with measures to discourage export bans on critical foods, to farmers by avoiding new restrictions for South African farmers, to fisher communities with protection against vessels that strip fish our waters, and to entrepreneurs in e-commerce by opening the door to an end to the moratorium on customs duties, or adequate support for developing countries in e-commerce. Much more will need to be done to build greater fairness and equity in global trade, and truly place development at the center of trade talks. But in that week of discussion in Geneva, developing countries were able to put forward a number of their concerns and get them incorporated in global decision making. And that wraps up the presentation, Chairperson. If I can then hand back to the Chair.
Thank you very much, Minister, for that presentation. We now have an hour or just under an hour. I think, Minister, let me just check. Shall we take questions now and then have a break and then we go back to the next presentation? Is that... You are muted, Minister.
Thank you, Chair. I would suggest so, Chair, because...
Okay.
It's quite a detailed presentation, and
yes.
It may be more helpful to members.
Okay. I see a hand from Honourable Cuthbert. Can I just take a hand from members' hands? Okay, while we're waiting for other hands, let me just take Honourable Cuthbert in the meantime. Members, the platform is open for you to raise your questions or clarities. I see other hands now. Malamecha and Honorable Fring. Okay, let's take those three for now. Honorable Cuthbert.
Thank you very much, Chair, and I think this was a very interesting presentation. I think it's the first of its kind that we've received throughout the period of the term. And I would encourage the Minister to give us more regular updates. I mean, some of the members of the committee have had the opportunity to go and visit the IWTO ambassador in Geneva and obviously hear from her as to what she thinks pertinent issues are. But I think it's very interesting to hear it directly from the Minister and to see what our positioning is on all of these global issues that are facing us. I think what's most disappointing from a WTO perspective is the continued impasse that surrounds the dispute resolution mechanism. And one would have thought that, a change of guard in the US government would have brought about, a restoration of normalized trade relations as well as the proper functioning of the dispute resolution mechanism. And I think that in itself has been rather disappointing. And I would have definitely liked to have seen a change of tack once that change of guard had happened. The second issue, Chairperson, is the exact same thing which I was told when I visited Ambassador Mulumbi Peter, was that we obviously had constrained policy space, and this obviously related to industrialization, and the Minister has repeated that today. Now, my understanding is the argument is that, Asian target countries such as South Korea, Taiwan, and so forth obviously made use of the lack of these rules to obviously industrialize the economies. And we often hear this as a reason why there's a lot of dissension at the WTO, particularly from the South African position. And I'd like to understand from the Minister what exact provisions are there that they feel prevent them from being able to industrialize in the same way that the Asian tigers did themselves. The other thing that I wanted to find out is I think a few months ago, an extraordinary step was taken by the South African government to launch a dispute against Spain and the European Union, if I'm correct, in light of citrus exports. I just wanted to know if the Minister could kindly give us a status update on that particular matter. And obviously, due to the dispute resolution mechanism, sort of being in stasis at this moment in time, I don't imagine that would be processed very quickly, but I'd like to hear, if there's any concessions that have been gained through initial talks with the parties on the WTO as well as the EU themselves, because I think that's a very important matter, and I think it's one where, particularly the opposition and government are aligned. We do find that a lot of phytosanitary standards that are put in place, particularly by the EU, are there to discriminate against South African goods and often on, scientifically spurious grounds. And I think that that's common cause amongst all parties to hold that particular view. So I think it would be interesting to find out what the minister's view is on that. Then just broadly relating to the other issues that have been raised by the minister, specifically regarding fisheries. I think that was a landmark agreement, and I welcome the work that was done on that. It can't be that industries are subsidised by their governments and then expect to play in the same pool as others. I think that subsidies distort trade, and particularly if they give an unfair comparative advantage to other economies. And we are quite vocal on trying to expand free trade and trying to make sure that we limit barriers. And I think it's important that we also identify where things such as fishery as well as agricultural subsidies distort trade and do not allow for fair trade amongst countries. Also, particularly considering the inherent advantage that others have, having industrialized and having had more developed economies much earlier on than what we. So that's just my broad comments for this morning, Chair. And once again, it was a very interesting presentation.
Thank you very much, Honourable Cuthbert. Honourable Malamacha.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, mine is also short. I think we will forever be driven by the talk that says business of business is business. One is much more concerned, especially if we are zoomed to fishery, to say as much as we want to balance and regulate the business itself in the water, now how, if to be specific with our own country, where large of people have been denied to be part and parcel of this sector on the basis of the granting of the licensing. Now, those who are in there say, no, only this scale is allowed for you to do business to avoid overproduction of fishes. Then, yet here, our intention is to bring as many as possible industrialists in a form of also balancing in redressing the past. Then, how do we seize ours so that when we are saying there's a fair play, even the players are fair in terms of the numbers? Because if we don't go that route, the danger is that those who have been there long are now monopolizing the entire sector and are benefiting more than those who are supposed to be coming in as the newcomers. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Tring. Honorable Tring, you are still muted.
Mm-hmm. Chair, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
All right.
Your reception is very poor.
Apologies, I'm actually traveling on my way to Chair, then that's the reason.
Okay.
I visited Germany, Minister, around 2008-2009. Together with a group called the Democracy Development Program, accompanied by colleagues from the ASC and the DA. Many of them at the time did not understand the effect of over-subsidization or subsidization by your developed countries and how that skews the playing field. So I'm quite interested to hear, because I raised it in Germany when we visited the German Parliament, and the representative from Germany acknowledged that it's unfair practice by particularly your developed nations as compared to your developing nations and poorer countries to apply that particular practice. So it's I'm quite interested to hear how far those negotiations are to scrap that kind of practice, particularly by your developed nations. And then secondly, Minister, the strength that your developed nations have in negotiations, because they, to a large extent, were the referees, perhaps, and players at the same time, when the rules regarding the WTO were actually established. How far also are negotiations in terms of leveling that particular playing field where, previously you had nations that had their veto powers, and one nation could actually just, veto a very good recommendation in terms of leveling playing fields. So those would be my two questions to the Minister. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Thring. Honorable Mbuyani.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Let me also welcome the presentation by the minister. At least now I'm able to follow because I once attended the TS. Chairperson, let me start with the MC12 now. In terms of the food security and also the agricultural declaration. The minister alluded to the fact that the MC12 was a success because at some stage they were able to agree in terms of food security and agriculture. And also there were decisions that were taken by the World Food Product, the Domestic Food Product Team, and also the process of safeguards. That some people must buy the surplus production. I just want to check the minister as well in terms of the TRIPS agreement, the waiver. Maybe I can cite an example, the US versus the China. The process of cannot export more than 50% of your production to other countries. And also specific production line and labeling in terms of that. Maybe the last one will be the question of what role should the trade and investment play in achieving a sustainable development? Because really, if trade cannot play a sustainable development role, that means maybe they will also be bounded by the plurilateralism, not the issue of... and also maybe ask the chair, the minister to check through you, Chairperson, the administrative part, because now there's WTO and also there's administration there, which is which, and I think the minister can be able to assist us to say, are we able to have the negotiation subcommittees at that level, or the administrative part, they can just negotiate on the side and have the arrangement before they come into the WTO. Maybe the last one, the Marrakesh agreement, in terms of the micro and the multilateral issues, the global renewal deal, the coherent narratives. I think the minister will be able to assist us because there was a narrative that if you want to deliver a trade agenda for sustainable future, we must be able to move from supply chain to value chain. That means you have to have mobility in terms of food and agriculture, and also governance and infrastructure that will be able to radically change in terms of the disruptions of food and the supply chain. No, I'll pause there for now, Chairperson. Maybe if I can get another chance. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Minister, over to you for responses. And I'll just hold on. I see Honorable Cuthbert has another question. Honorable Cuthbert.
Thanks, Chair. Sorry, I omitted this at the beginning. Just the other two questions that I wanted to ask the Minister. The first one being is I have previously engaged with the Department on, you know, why there's been not much movement, particularly on, you know, electronic goods and services. And one of the reasons forwarded to me was obviously a lack of local capacity. Now, if you look at the way in which the master plans are structured and the industries that have been identified, there hasn't been too much focus on, you know, industries that could allow us to develop this kind of capability. And in light of, you know, the ongoing negotiations as well as, you know, the timelines that have been set for the moratorium to come to an end. Would it not then be prudent for focus to be placed on these kinds of industries that emanate, you know, from this kind of agreement, and to make sure that we have the necessary capacity to compete on this front, in addition to the revenue collection benefit we would get, you know, by instituting certain tariffs on these items which are currently tariff-free. The last thing that I just want to mention, Chair, and it's maybe a little bit more of a comment, but you would have seen, Minister, that President Xi Jinping and President Biden met on the sidelines of the G20 and in essence agreed to a lowering of the temperature between China and the US. What is your personal view on how this will bode for, you know, future negotiations with the like of the WTO? Because we would know that that was one site of serious conflict that led to, you know, the suspension of the dispute resolution mechanism. And, you know, how would you use this particular, you know, tempering down of the situation to try and advance our own trade goals and objectives from a South African perspective?
Thank you, Honourable Custard. Back to you, Minister.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. First, let me thank members for what I thought were some really insightful questions that have come out, and also thank you for the comments with which members received the presentation. If I start with the broader question that Honourable Cuthbert raised at the start on the constrained policy space, and say that essentially if we look at the development of the Asian Tiger model, but even before that, we look at the history of industrialization in Europe. During the period when those rapid industrialization programs took off, there were no what are called in trade talks, there were no disciplines that were imposed on national governments by anyone outside a national government itself. So parliaments would do so, cabinets would do so, but there would be a high degree of policy autonomy and policy space. And countries were able to develop using a range of tools, and some of these would be the use of strategic subsidies and technical support. For example, in the United States, the U.S. has built a formidable technological base to their economy, in part through quite a targeted spending on military. Through the military budget, the United States has been able to secure groundbreaking breakthroughs that were then applied to industrial products. In fact, there's a very interesting bit of work that has been done by Mariana Mazzucato, who serves on the President's Economic Advisory Council. And she's taken the mobile phone, the smartphone, and she's broken down the different components that make up that phone and showed how state support in a number of areas, from the GS, from the global satellite positioning to the touch screen, to a range of other components, have benefited from investment by governments in science and innovation, which of course is an important driver of industrial development. In the era of the WTO, for traditional sectors, you're talking your clothing and textile sector, steel and so on, there's been significant disciplines put on any support that can be rendered by governments for their local industries to help transform those industries into more competitive technology-led industries. Those same disciplines don't apply to many parts of the spending by governments, particularly in developed countries, although to be fair, not only in developed countries. So that's one example of it. The second example of it is the strategic use of tariffs. Now, as we've discussed in the committee previously, a country that seeks simply to put up its tariffs to the highest level across all products is likely to find that it gets temporary benefit, but with a real danger that its economy becomes uncompetitive because local players can rely on that protection and are unchallenged. They don't have the need to innovate, to find better processes, technologies, improve skills, higher productivity, and so on. On the other hand, we have not seen many successes in instances where countries have just, in an unstrategic manner, removed all of their protection. So historically, both Asian tigers and the earlier phase of development, developed countries were able to use targeted and carefully calibrated tariffs to support their industries. In fact, interestingly, we've seen a return to some of that now by developed countries. The Uruguay round introduced a number of disciplines that limits the ability of states to use the instruments of public power to try to improve the competitiveness of their industry. And if I can link that to an observation made by Honorable Mbuyane on shifting to value chains. Global supply chains are a critical part of a global economy in which we are interdependent. If South Africa was sought to cut itself off from the world and not trade, there would be no place left for us to sell our gold and our platinum and our other mineral riches. And so in that sense, trade makes a lot of sense. The challenge is trade in what? If you limit yourself to trade in only minerals and agricultural products, the return to you as a country is very limited. So countries all look to move up the value chain. They don't only want to be in someone's supply chain producing widgets. They want to get to the point where you have the highest return to the entrepreneurs, the best wages to workers, and the best opportunity for governments to secure a share of that through taxation that can then be used to build either social systems, welfare systems, or economic support systems like the science and technology systems, public universities, and so on. So that's what trade talks is about, how to get to a point where we have countries across the world with divergent interests that build a common set of rules. Uruguay was, in one way, a big step forward for the world because it led to the World Trade Organization that said that instead of power being the only basis for decision-making, we'll have an agreed set of rules and we'll have a dispute settlement system in instances where any one country believes another country has not obeyed the rules, have not worked within the rules. On the other hand, Uruguay, though, locked some developing countries. South Africa was a classic example because of the stage of transition we were at. It locked us into commitments that gives us less flexibility in some areas than even developed countries have in respect of the kind of support that we can give either in service markets or in goods markets. So that's really what that is about. So I've given these two examples. I can also say, of course, the Asian tigers benefited enormously from very strong preferential access, unilateral access to markets. We have benefited as South Africa and as Sub-Saharan Africa from AGOA, and we're seeking to secure more of that gain in future. And we had that conversation at the last time that I had an opportunity to address the committee. Turning to the dispute settlement mechanism, I think, Honourable Cuthbert, you're absolutely right that this is an area that is quite fundamental to the operation of the global trading system. If you have rules, you need to have an adjudicative process to determine how to deal with breaches of those rules. In the World Trade Organization, it's quite a complex one. Let me take the point before the collapse of the dispute settlement mechanism. When one country, let's say the United States is an example, or India is an example, provides support to their industries, another country can challenge that. So India, for example, in order to build a green industrial economy, put in place some support mechanisms for their for the production of components for the green industry, and there was a complaint raised against them. In that complaint, there's first there are two levels at which it's taken. The first level is really a panel that seeks to get to a finding on the facts and encourage the parties to implement the finding. The more difficult one is where there's a binding decision that is taken by the appellate body of the dispute settlement system, which is then binding not only on that country, but it over time has developed what you can call a jurisprudence on trade. Now, from the United States point of view, they've taken the view that the jurisprudence that is developing was never agreed to by WTO members, that WTO members have looked at these dispute settlement bodies to deal with a case-specific outcome and no more than that, and that sovereign countries are now trapped in a body of international law that they haven't signed up on. So that would be the one argument that the United States raised. From the South African side, we've raised the issue that if you don't have a binding dispute settlement system, then even though you have trade rules, powerful countries can impose their will. And a very good example is the measures taken by the United States against South African steel and aluminium exports, where there is no coherent ground on trade law for excluding South African products, and the United States has relied on essentially a national security provision, the section 232 of that they've applied to limit the export of steel and aluminium by South Africa. We seek now to have a fit-for-purpose dispute settlement mechanism because developing countries have not been completely happy with the old system. It's cumbersome. It's extremely expensive. Requires enormous resources that many smaller countries are unable to put in place. So a wider reform of the dispute settlement mechanism is necessary. But we have both bilaterally with the United States and in the wider discussion emphasized the importance of resolving the impasse on particularly the appellate body of the WTO. On Spain, yes, we've started the proceedings in the World Trade Organization. We've also had very extensive discussions we've had with the European Union. I have met with the Vice President of the European Union, who also holds the portfolio of Trade Commissioner, to put forward South Africa's concerns. We've met with the Spanish government during the recent state visit, and we are now engaged in discussions I had asked a team of officials to go to Brussels recently to engage with their counterparts, and I am now due to have a further engagement with my counterpart. We remain hopeful that we are, that we will be able to resolve the matter of particularly false codling moth. This is the latest sanitary and phytosanitary issue that the European Union has used to block effectively South African exports of citrus products. Now, it's the second one. Before that, it was citrus black spot. And what we've said to the European Union is that for more than 100 years, South Africa exported citrus fruit to the European countries. This is even predating the European Union. And all of the fears that Europe now raises that citrus black spot can jump from oranges that we export to Europe onto their orange trees and affect their production. None of that has been scientifically shown. On the contrary, there is no evidence of any of the fears that Europe has raised. And we've made the point that it's at the time when South African farmers became more successful globally and in the European market in selling citrus products that suddenly these plant diseases, as they would regard them, were discovered and are being used now to limit our entry to the European market. And we've made this, we've said this is a fundamental issue for us. And so we will seek to first have a solution through dialogue and discussion, but failing that, we will take the matter to the highest level. There are a number of ways in which we can address the issue of a dysfunctional pellet body in the World Trade Organization when we take the citrus matter up. We also have the facility available to have agreed arbitration with a panel of arbitrators that are chosen between the parties. But our hope still is that in the discussions that are underway at the moment, we can reach an agreement. We have found that in engaging the Spanish government, and Spain, of course, is the world's biggest exporter of citrus fruit. South Africa is the world's second biggest exporter, that the Spanish government has acknowledged that they understand the depth of concern that South Africa has, and this has been elevated at the time of discussion by the president with his counterpart, Prime Minister Sanchez. President Ramaphosa has also raised it with the president of the European Union himself, and we are engaging with other senior members of the European Union. I hope when we have an opportunity in the new year that I can give a more detailed report, or at least a more positive report. Obviously, because we engage in the negotiations at the moment, I'm going to be a little bit constrained on some of the specific points that South Africa is raising. But this is the wider issue. Is absolutely true that we've seen, particularly in Europe, a greater use of sanitary and phytosanitary measures to limit our products, whether they are game meat that we sell in the European Union, whether it is the export of horses to Europe and to the Middle East, whether it is access for some of our other livestock and access for other agricultural products. So the world is seeing now some countries, some trading blocs are using SPS measures as disguised protection for their markets. And this is a challenge that we're going to have to crack in the World Trade Organization. There are legitimate SPS measures that countries are entitled to use, but we've seen a greater use of it than is warranted. On the fisheries agreement, it was a landmark agreement in many respects, and it was particularly important to South Africa because honorable members will know that our coastline is very long, and it's been and have done so often contrary to the rules. And this is an opportunity now for us to have a rules-based system. South Africa was nominated by a large group of fishing nations, the ACP nations, and the African, Caribbean, and Pacific nations to coordinate the input of ACP countries in the World Trade Organization talks. We had very positive conversations with the European Union and with the United States. We engaged in a lot of detail with India, who was very concerned about artisanal and subsistence fishing. And we were able, through those engagements, to contribute to laying the basis for what was finally an agreement that was reached at the WTO. On e-commerce, I think, Honorable Cuthbert, the point that you've made is an important one, that for South Africa, while there are two objectives, yes, we want to ensure that we are able to have access to the revenue collection, but even more fundamentally is to develop an e-commerce capability. We're already quite a significant e-commerce player. Both in our domestic economy, we have significant platforms, and we are one of the leading ones on the African continent. But compared, say, to the enormous capacity that the United States or China has, think of Amazon, think of Alibaba, we are relatively small players. So what we've done is, while there hasn't been a master plan specifically on e-commerce, what we have done is we've put a master plan in place around global business services, which of course is a form of services that is mediated through these digital platforms. So essentially, there are tens of thousands of South Africans now who are employed to be the call agents that provide services. So if you're a customer in a bank in England and you phone your local bank to query, let's say, an overdraft amount or something like that, the call is routed to South Africa through our electronic infrastructure. And it's answered by a South African, perhaps a woman in Mitchell's Plain or from Khayelitsha, who then takes the customer through the issue. So that's already a growing part of our offering, but there's a lot more that we can do. So part of our discussion at the World Trade Organization has been precisely that, how we can get the necessary space to build an e-commerce and to strengthen our e-commerce infrastructure. So the Global Business Services is one leg, the WTO is another leg, and then the third leg is the Competition Commission is doing the market inquiry that's looking at a number of these online platforms. They include e-commerce platforms, the various platforms around accommodation, car purchases, property purchases, and so on. It is our intention that the work would be completed by or before the end of February, and this will give enormous insight and also outcomes, measures that can be taken that introduces more competition and more capability in this market. So this is, more and more people globally are being employed in this area, it does raise quite significant and deep competition issues, which the Competition Commission is looking at now. But this is an area that we want to back more growth of the sector and also find opportunities for small businesses to really thrive in that ecosystem. Honorable Malametra has made a really important contribution around the history of industrialization. And it was famously said that developed countries kick away the ladder of development, the very means that they've used to build their capacity is then kicked away, that developing countries that follow in their wake are unable to utilize. Then Honorable Malametsa also raised the question on the fisheries industry. How we resolve local fishery industry challenges by granting them licenses and avoid the monopolization of the sector. Now, that's domestic policy. It doesn't go directly to the trade talks at the World Trade Organization, but I know Minister Barbara Creasy is very aware of this challenge and is seeking to find ways in which the licensing system and the quota system enables smaller players to come in. Here's the challenge. The challenge is that for those quotas and those licenses to be meaningful, we need to ensure that our coastline is not overfished. And that's where the World Trade Organization talks come in, that while it has not resolved all of the issues, within the toolkit of the World Trade Organization, it's taken a significant step forward, Honorable Malametsa. Honorable Tring has raised the question of subsidies by developed nations and the leveling of the playing fields. The irony is, Honorable Tring, that in agriculture, not only don't we have a level playing field with enormous subsidies by developed nations, but the effect of that is that one of the few ways in which many developing countries can improve the quality of life and the employment for their own citizens is being closed off, which then leads to more people getting onto little ships, crossing the Mediterranean, and trying to find a livelihood in Europe. So Europe will continue to have enormous migration challenges with large numbers of people moving there as long as Africa remains in a state of underdevelopment and African farmers don't have access to the markets. So when you block African products, unavoidably you're going to find Africans themselves in desperation will seek to enter those societies, those countries. And so a new deal is necessary that rebalances the ability of developing countries to build stronger economies and economies that are able to meet the needs of their people. And so the points, Honorable Tring, that you've raised and Honorable Malametsa and Honorable Cuthbert have raised all speak, I think, quite strongly to the same issue, and government is out there fighting on exactly these issues. Honorable Mbuyane, the matters of food security, as you rightly point out, came up in MC12. We were particularly keen to support the World Food Program, that the work that is being done by a number of countries to ensure that wherever possible, we're able to buy food stocks that can go to parts of the world that are either gripped in a cycle of poverty or where there's a natural disaster like a drought or floods and so on. And we were able to secure critical protection for those measures in the World Trade Organization. On the TRIPS waiver, historically, the flexibilities in the TRIPS agreement were available to countries that want to use it subject to a number of rules, but they could not use it such that they export the majority of the product. Now, if you're a very big economy, that may not be such a big constraint. But if you are South Africa, it means you could never really use that, because if you're producing only for the South African market, the product will be so expensive and it will be therefore unaffordable. So the very need you're trying to address to get access to citizens or for citizens to life-saving medication will not be realized. So within the very flexibilities of the original TRIPS rules, there is a break put in that mean you can't move forward. So we spend a lot of time seeking to put this argument to the European Union, to the United States, to the UK, Switzerland, Japan, and other countries that were originally concerned about the waiver proposal. And in the final document, there is no such constraint. As long as we export to other developing countries that are eligible under this term. So that was quite an important breakthrough. Trade and investment really are big drivers of development. You're not able to create jobs and improve the lives of citizens by governments simply running public works programs and so on. There's a role for it. But fundamentally, it's about the ability to increase your industrialization footprint to produce more. And while we've emphasized localization, clawing back more on the domestic market, South Africa also has to export more of that product. Because when you export on scale, your markets are bigger, your prices come down, your innovation, your resources for innovation is more. And also, the disciplines of exporting means that you're forced to find ways of constantly becoming more competitive. So it's the combination of all these measures that I think were highlighted in the World Trade Organization talks. Finally, coming to Honorable Cuthbert's question on President Xi Jinping and President Biden seeking to temper down the heat that has been generated over geopolitical tensions. I think it's good for global trade and development, because wars, and not only the kind of wars that we've seen in Ukraine where the parties are engaged in battle, but also the potential threats of physical conflict, as we've seen in the South China Seas area, disrupt global supply chains. South African automakers, for example, were forced to close their operations here in South Africa for a number of days because there was a shortage of semiconductors, what they call these chips that go into the making of the electronic systems for cars. And that was in part as a result of COVID, but also the geopolitical tensions have contributed to and exacerbated these ones. What South Africa seeks to do is to position South Africa and the African continent as an important source for the production of goods in a world where risk is being factored much more into decision makers' calculation. That if you want to de-risk, you need to expand your procurement to South Africa and to the African continent. So instead of high-risk procurement where the world's entire supply of a given product is in one country or one region, we're seeking now to position the African continent as a critical means for businesses, whether those businesses are in China or they are in the United States, for them to de-risk their supply chain. In addition to that, the lowering of global tensions will also encourage more investment, because investors often press the pause button in periods of heightened tension. And in the president's investment conference in April next year, in the context of lower global tensions, we are likely to have a stronger appetite from global investors to invest in South Africa. And thirdly, of course, export markets, that if tensions are lowered, it provides an opportunity for South Africa to sell more of our own products in markets elsewhere in the world. Those markets are often more constrained in times of global tension. So on the investment side, on the trade side, meaning South Africa and the African continent as a procurement destination, and through our exports, all of those can benefit from a world that is at peace, or at least a world where there are lower levels of global tensions. So thank you very much, Chairperson, for these probing, thoughtful, and very strategic questions that honorable members have raised that all go to areas that are important for us in the conduct of our work in the World Trade Organization. And I think all South Africans can be very proud, because it was really the collective work of South Africa Inc. That in the World Trade Organization, South Africa was able to provide enormous leadership at times when it looked, in those early few days in Geneva, it looked like the trade talks would all stall and deadlock. And South Africa, our negotiators, played a key role in reaching out to many different parts of the world and helping to bring parties together into what was ultimately a meaningful set of agreements that were reached. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Minister, for that update. Honourable Mbeyane, is that the legacy hand? Or do you have any questions?
Sorry, Chair. It's a legacy hand.
Okay, no, that's fine. Members, we will now take a break until, I think, let's see if we can restart at 11:05. So we'll just take a 15-minute break, and then, Minister, we'll go back to you. I think you need to give your vocal cords a bit of a rest before we continue. Thank you very much, members. We'll break for 15 minutes. Thank you.